Teresa canted a shoulder toward the director, as if taking him into her confidence. My husband is so stuffy about what I wear. And what do you think, Director Linscott? Do you approve of my dress? Teresa beamed proudly. Do you like it? Linscott glanced down from Teresa's eyes only briefly.
Quite lovely, my dear, quite lovely.
You see, Dalton, I told you, my dress is much more conservative than the others. I'm delighted one so widely respected as yourself approves, Director Linscott. While Teresa turned to a passing cupbearer for a refill, Dalton gave Linscott a why-didn't-you-help-me look. Linscott shrugged and bent to Dalton's ear.
Your wife is a lovely, endearing woman, he whispered. I couldn't very well humiliate and disappoint her.
Dalton made a show of sighing.
My problem exactly.
Linscott straightened, smiling all the way. Director, Dalton said more seriously. Claudine here had a terrible accident earlier. While taking a walk outside, she caught her foot and took a nasty tumble.
Dear spirits, Linscott took up her hand. Are you badly hurt, my dear?
It was nothing, Claudine mumbled.
I've known Edwin a good many years. I'm sure your husband would be understanding if I helped you to your rooms. Here, take my arm, and I will see you safely to your bed.
As he took a sip, Dalton watched over the top of his cup. Her eyes swept the room. Those eyes held a world of longing to accept his offer. She might be safe if she did. He was a powerful man, and would have her under his wing. This test would tell him what he needed to know. It wasn't really a huge risk to play out such an experiment. People did disappear, after all, without ever being found. Still, there were risks in it. He waited for Claudine to tell him which way it would go. At last, she did.
Thank you for your concern, Director Linscott, but I'm fine. I have so looked forward to the feast and seeing the guests come to the estate. I would forever regret missing it and seeing our Minister of Culture speak.
Linscott took a sip of wine.
You and Edwin have labored vigorously on new laws since he was elected Burgess. You have worked with the minister. What do you think of the man?
He gestured with his cup for emphasis.
Your honest opinion now.
Claudine took a gulp of wine. She had to catch her breath. She stared at nothing as she spoke.
Minister Chanbor is a man of honor. His policies have been good for Andereth. He has been respectful of the laws Edwin has proposed.
She took another gulp of wine.
We are fortunate to have Bertrand Chanbor as the Minister of Culture. I have a hard time imagining another man who could do everything he does.
Linscott lifted an eyebrow.
Quite a ringing endorsement from a woman of your renown. We all know that you, Claudine, are as important to those laws as Edwin.
You are too kind, she mumbled, staring into her cup. I am just the wife of an important man. I would be little missed and quickly forgotten were I to have broken my neck out there tonight. Edwin will be honored long and well.
Linscott puzzled at the top of her head.
Claudine thinks far too little of herself, Dalton said.
He caught sight of the seneschal, impeccably dressed in a long-tailed red coat crossed with a sash of many colors, opening the double doors. Beyond the doors, the lavers with rose petals floating in them awaited the guests. Dalton turned to the director.
I suppose you know who will be the guest of honor tonight.
Linscott frowned.
Guest of honor?
A representative from the Imperial Order, a high-ranking man by the name of Stein. Come to tell us Eperage Gang's words. Dalton took another sip.
Sovereign has come, too, to hear those words.
Linscott sighed with the weight of this news. Now the man knew why he had been summoned, along with the other directors, to what they had thought was no more than an ordinary feast at the estate. The Sovereign, for his own safety, rarely announced his appearances in advance. He had arrived with his own special guards and a large contingent of servants. Teresa's face glowed as she smiled up at Dalton, eager for the evening's events. Claudine stared at the floor.
"Ladies and gentlemen," the seneschal announced, "if it would please you, dinner is served."
Chapter 21 She spread her wings, and her rich voice sang out with the somber strains of a tale more ancient than myth. Came the visions of icy beauty from the land of death where they dwell. Pursuing their prize in grisly duty came the thieves of the charm and spell. The bells chimed thrice, and death came a-calling. alluring of shape though seldom seen, they traveled the breeze on a spark. Some fed twigs to their newborn queen, while others invaded the dark. The bells chimed thrice, and death came a-calling. Some they called, and others they kissed, as they traveled on river and wave. With resolve they came and did insist, everyone touched to a grave. The bells chimed thrice, and death came a-calling. Roving to hunt and gathering to dance, they practiced their dark desires by casting a hex and a beautiful trance before feeding the queen's new fires. The bells chimed thrice, and death came a-calling. Till he parted the falls, and the bells chimed thrice, till he issued the calls and demanded the price, the bells chimed thrice, and death met the mountain. They charmed and embraced as they tried to extol, but he bade them in grace and demanded a soul. The bells fell silent, and the mountain slew them all, and the mountain entombed them all. With an impossibly long note, the young woman concluded her bewitching song. The guests broke into applause. It was an archaic lyric of Joseph Ander, and for that reason alone was cherished. Dalton had once leafed through old texts to see what he could learn of the song's meaning, but found nothing to shed light on the intent of the words, which, there being a number of versions, weren't always the same. It was one of those songs which no one really understood, but everyone treasured, because it was obviously a triumph of some sort for one of their land's beloved venerable founders. For the sake of tradition, the haunting melody was sung on special occasions. For some reason, Dalton had the odd feeling that the words now meant more to him than ever before. They seemed somehow nearly to make sense. As quickly as the sensation came, his mind was on to other things, and the feeling passed. The woman's long sleeves skimmed the floor as she held her arms wide while bowing to the sovereign, and then once again to the applauding people at the head table beside the sovereign's table. A baldachin of silk and gold brocade ran up the wall behind and then in billowing folds out over the two head tables. The baldachin's corners were held up with outsized Andereth lances. The effect was to make the head tables appear as if they were on a stage, which in many ways Dalton supposed they were. The songstress bowed to the diners at the long rows of tables running down each side of the dining hall. Her sleeves were overlaid with spotted white owl feathers, so that when she spread her arms in song, she appeared to be a winged woman, like something out of the ancient stories she sang. Stein, on the other side of the applauding minister and his wife, applauded apathetically, no doubt envisioning the young woman without her feathers. On Dalton's right, Teresa added enthusiastic calls of admiration to her clapping. Dalton stifled a yawn as he applauded. As the songstress strode away, her arms lifted to wave in winged acknowledgement of the whistles trailing after her. After she'd vanished, four squires entered from the opposite side of the room, carrying a platform atop which sat a marzipan ship floating in a sea of marzipan waves. The ship's billowing sails looked to be made of spun sugar. The purpose, of course, was to announce that the next course would be fish, just as the pastry deer, pursued by pastry hounds leaping a hedge of holly in which hid aspic boar, had announced one of the meat courses, and the stuffed eagle with its huge wings spread over a scene of the capital city of Fairfield, made of paperboard buildings, had announced a course of fowl. Up in the gallery, a fanfare trumpeted and drums rolled to add a musical testament to the arrival of the next course. There had been five courses, each with at least a dozen specialties. That meant there were seven courses yet to come, each with at least a dozen distinctive dishes of its own. Music from flute and fife and drum, jugglers, troubadours, and acrobats entertained the guests between courses as a tree with candied fruits toured the tables. Gifts of mechanical horses with opposing legs that moved in unison were passed out to the delight of all. Meat dishes had included everything from Teresa's all-time favorite of suckers. She had eaten three of the infant rabbits, to fawn, to pig, to cow, to a bear standing on its hind legs. The bear was wheeled from table to table. At each table, its hide, draped around the roasted carcass, was pulled back to allow carvers to slice off pieces for the guests. Fowl ranged from the sparrows the minister favored for their stimulation of lust, to pigeons, to swan's neck pudding, to eagles, to baked heron that had been refeathered and held by wires in a display depicting them as a flock in flight. It was not expected that everyone would eat such a plenitude of food. The variety was meant to offer an abundance of choice, not only to please honored guests, but to astonish them with opulence. A visit to the Minister of Culture's estate was an occasion long remembered, and for many probably became a legendary event talked about for years. As they sampled the dishes, most people kept an eye to the head table, where the minister sat with two wealthy backers he had invited to dine at his table, and the other object of great interest, the representative from the Imperial Order. Stein had arrived earlier to the whispered ooing and eyeing of all at his man-of-war outfit and cape of human scalps. He was a sensation, drawing the inviting looks of a number of women weak in the knees at the prospect of winning such a man to their bed. In vivid outward contrast to the warrior from the old world, Bertrand Chanbour wore a close-fitting, sleeveless, padded purple doublet, embellished with elaborate embroidery, gold trim, and silver braiding over a simple-sleeved short jacket. Together they gave his soft, rounded shape the illusion of a more manly frame. A frill of white stood above the doublet's low, erect collar. A similar ruff stood out at wrists and waist. Slung over the shoulders of the doublet and short jacket was a magnificent dress coat of a deeper purple, with fur trim running around the collar and all the way down the front. Below the padded rolls, standing at the ends of the shoulders, the baggy sleeves had slashes lined with red silk. Between the spiral slashes, galloon braiding separated rows of pearls. With his intent eyes, his easy smile, which, along with those eyes, always seemed directed at no other than the person with whom he had eye contact at the moment, and his shock of thick, graying hair, he struck an impressive figure. That and Bertrand Chanbour's presence, or rather the presence of the power he wielded as the Minister of Culture, left many a man in awed admiration and many a woman in breathless yearning. If not watching the minister's table, guests cast stealthy glances at the table beside it, where sat the sovereign, his wife, and their three grown-up sons and two grown daughters. No one wanted to stare openly at the sovereign. The sovereign was, after all, the Creator's deputy in the world of life, a holy religious leader as well as the ruler of their land. Many in Andorath, Anders and Haken alike, idolized the sovereign to the point of falling to the ground, wailing and confessing sins when his carriage passed. The sovereign, alert and perceptive despite deteriorating health, was dressed in a glittering golden garment. A red vest emphasized the outfit's bulbous sleeves. A long, richly colored, embroidered silk stole was draped over his shoulders. Bright yellow stockings laced at mid-thigh to the bottom of teardrop-shaped, puffed and padded breeches with colored slashes. Jewels weighed each finger. The sovereign's head hovered low between his rounded shoulders, as if the gold medallion displaying a diamond-encrusted mountain had over time weighed so heavily on his neck that it bowed his back. Liver spots as large as the jewels mottled his hands. The sovereign had outlived four wives. With loving care, the man's latest wife dabbed at the food on his chin. Dalton doubted she was yet out of her teens. Thankfully, even though the sons and daughters brought their spouses, they had left their children home. The sovereign's grandchildren were insufferable brats. No one dared do anything more than chuckle approvingly at the little darlings as they rampaged unchecked. Several of them were considerably older than their latest step-grandmother. On the other side of the minister from Dalton, Lady Hildemara Chanbour, in an elegant silvery pleated gown cut as low as any in the room, gestured with one finger, and the harpist, stationed before but below the head table's raised platform, gently trailed her soft music to silence. The minister's wife directed the feast. It actually needed no directing from her, but she insisted she be acknowledged as the regal hostess of the majestic and stately event, and therefore from time to time contributed to the proceedings by lifting her finger to silence the harpist at the appropriate time so that all might know and respect her social position. People were spellbound, believing the entire feast turned on Lady Chanbour's finger. The harpist certainly knew when she was to let her music end for an impending slated event, but nonetheless waited and watched for that noble finger before daring to still her own. Sweat dotted her brow as she watched for Lady Chanbour's finger to rise, daring not to miss it. Though universally proclaimed radiant and beautiful, Hildemara was rather thick of limb and feature, and had always put Dalton in mind of a sculpture of a woman chiseled by an artisan of greater ardor than talent. It was not a piece of work one wished to consider for long stretches. The harpist took the chance of the break to reach for a cup on the floor beside her golden harp. As she bent forward for the cup, the minister ogled her cleavage, at the same time giving Dalton an elbow in the ribs lest he miss the sight. Lady Chanbor noticed her husband's roving eye, but showed no reaction. She never did. She relished the power she wielded, and willingly paid the requisite price. In private, though, Hildemar occasionally clouted Bertrand with any handy object, more likely for a social slight to her than a marital indiscretion. She had no real cause to raise objections to his philandering. She was not exactly faithful, enjoying at times the discreet company of lovers. Dalton kept a mental list of their names. Dalton suspected that, like many of her husband's dalliances, her partners were attracted to her power and hoped they might earn a favor. Most people had no clue as to what went on at the estate, and could imagine her as nothing other than a faithful, loving wife, an image she cultivated with care. The Andereth people loved her as the people of other lands loved the queen. In many ways, she was the power behind the office of minister. She was adept, knowledgeable, focused. While Bertrand was often at play, Hildemar, behind closed doors, issued orders. He relied on his wife's expertise, often deferring to her in material matters. Disinterested in what patronage she doled out to miscreants, or the cultural carnage she left in her wake. No matter what she might think of her husband in private, Hildemar worked zealously to preserve his dominion. If he fell, she would surely crash down with him. Unlike her husband, Hildemar was rarely drunk and discreetly confined whatever couplings she had to the middle of the night. Dalton knew better than to underestimate her. She tended cobwebs of her own. The company gasped with delighted surprise when a sailor sprang from behind the marzipan ship, piping a merry fisher's tune on his fife while accompanying himself on a tabor hung from his belt. Teresa giggled and clapped, as did many others. She squeezed her husband's leg under the table. "Oh, Dalton, did you ever think we would live at such a splendid place, come to know such splendid people and see such splendid things?" "Of course." She giggled again and gently bumped his shoulder with hers. Dalton watched Claudine applaud from a table to the right. To his left, Stein stabbed a chunk of meat and, with shameless manners, pulled it from the knife with his teeth. He chewed with his mouth open as he viewed the entertainment. This didn't look to be the sort of entertainment Stein favored. Servers had already begun carrying in silver chargers of the fish course, taking them to the dresser table for saucing and dressing before service. The sovereign had his own servants at a sideboard to taste and prepare his food. They used knives they had brought with them to slice off for the sovereign and his family the choice upper crust of rolls and breads. They had other knives just to prepare the trenchers upon which the sovereign's food was placed, which, unlike everyone else's plates, were changed after each course. They had one knife to slice, one to trim, and one just to smooth the trenchers. The minister leaned close, his fingers holding a slice of pork he had dipped in mustard. "I heard a rumor that there is a woman who might be inclined to spread unpleasant lies. Perhaps you should inquire after the matter?" From the platter he shared with Teresa, Dalton plucked up, with his second finger and thumb, a slice of pear and almond milk. "Yes, minister, I already have. She intends no disrespect." He popped the pear in his mouth. The minister lifted an eyebrow. "Well and good, then." He grinned and winked past Dalton. Smiling, Teresa bowed her head in acknowledgment of his greeting. "Ah, my dear Teresa, have I yet told you that you look especially divine this evening? And your hair is wondrous. It makes you look as if you are a good spirit come to grace my table. If you weren't married to my right-hand man, I'd invite you to dance later." The minister rarely danced with anyone but his wife, and, as a matter of protocol, visiting dignitaries. "Minister, I would be honored," Teresa said, stumbling over the words. "As would my husband, I'm sure. I could be in no better hands on the dance floor, or anywhere." Despite Teresa's usual ability to maintain a state of social equanimity, she blushed at the high honor Bertrand had almost extended. She fussed with the glittering sequins tied in her hair, aware of envious eyes watching her speak with the Minister of Culture himself. Dalton knew by the scowl behind the minister that there was no need to fret that such a dance, with the man doubtlessly pressing up against Teresa's half-exposed bosom, would take place. Lady Chanbor would not have Bertrand formally showing such a lack of complete devotion to her. Dalton returned to business, steering the conversation in the direction of his intentions. "One of the officials from the city is very concerned about the situation we spoke of." "What did he say?" Bertrand knew which director they were discussing, and wisely refrained from using names aloud, but his eyes flashed anger.
Nothing, Dalton assured him. But the man is persistent. He might inquire after matters, press for explanations. There are those who conspire against us and would be eager to stir the cry of impropriety. It would be a bothersome waste of time and take us away from our duty to the Andereth people, were we forced to acquit ourselves of groundless accusations of misconduct.
The whole idea is absurd, Minister said as he followed in the form of their cover conversation. You don't really believe, do you, that people really plot to oppose our good works?
His words sounded by rote. He used them so often. Simple prudence required that public discussion be circumspect. There might be gifted people slipped in among the guests, hoping to use their skill to overhear something not meant to be heard. Dalton himself employed a gifted woman with such talent.
We devote our lives to doing the work of the Andereth people, Dalton said. And yet there are those greedy few who would wish to stall the progress we make on behalf of the working people.
From the trencher he shared with his wife, Bertrand picked up a roasted swan wing and dragged it through a small bowl of frumenty sauce.
You think fomenters might be intending to cause trouble, then?
Lady Chanbur, closely following the conversation, leaned close to her husband.
Agitators would jump at the chance to destroy Bertrand's good work. They would willingly aid any troublemaker.
She glanced pointedly to the sovereign, being fed from the fingers of his young wife.
We have important work before us and don't need antagonists meddling in our efforts.
Bertrand Chanbur was the most likely candidate to be named sovereign, but there were those who opposed him. Once named, a sovereign served for life. Any slip at such a critical time could remove the minister from consideration. There were any number of people wishing he would make such a slip, and they would be watching and listening for it. After Bertrand Chanbur was named sovereign, they would be free of worry, but until then nothing was certain or safe. Dalton bowed his head in acknowledgement.
You see the situation well, Lady Chanbur.
Bertrand let out a little grunt.
I take it you have a suggestion.
I do, Dalton said, lowering his voice to little more than a whisper. It was impolite to be seen whispering, but it was unavoidable. He needed to act, and whispers would not be heard.
I think it would be best if we upset the balance of things. What I have in mind will not only pull the weed from the wheat, but it will discourage other weeds from springing up.
Keeping an eye to the sovereign's table, Dalton explained his proposal. Lady Chanbur straightened with a sly smile. Dalton's advice pleased her disposition. Without emotion, Bertrand, as he watched Claudine picking at her food, agreed. Stein dragged his knife blade across the table, making a show of slicing through the fine white linen overcloth.
Why don't I just slit their throats?
The minister glanced about, checking to see if he could tell if anyone had overheard Stein's offer. Ildemar's face flushed with anger. Teresa's went white to hear such talk, especially from a man who wore a cape of human scalps. Stein had been warned before. If overheard and reported, such words could open the floodgates of investigation, which would undoubtedly bring the mother confessor herself down on them. She would not rest until she discovered the truth of it, and if that happened, she very well might be inclined to use her magic to remove the minister from office, for good. With a deadly look, Dalton delivered a silent threat to Stein. Stein grinned out through yellow teeth.
Just a friendly joke.
I don't care how large the Imperial Order's force is, the minister growled for the ears of any who might have heard Stein. Unless they are invited through, which is yet to be decided, they will all perish before the Domini Dirge. The Emperor knows the truth of it, or he wouldn't ask us to consider the generous offers of peace he has made. I'm sure he would be displeased to know how one of his men insults our culture and the laws by which we live. You are here as a delegate from Emperor Jigang to explain to our people the Emperor's position and liberal offers, no more. If need be, we can get another to do such explaining.
Stein smirked at all the agitation directed his way.
I was joking, of course. Such empty talk is the custom among my people. Where I come from, such words are common and harmless. I assure you all, it was only meant for the sake of amusement.
I hope you intend to exercise better judgment when you speak to our people, the minister said. This is a serious matter you have come to discuss. The directors would not appreciate hearing such offensive humor.
Stein let out a coarse laugh.
Master Campbell did explain your culture's intolerance for such crude banter, but my unpolished nature caused me to forget his wise words. Please excuse my poor choice of a joke. No harm was intended.
Well and good, then.
Bertrand leaned back, his wary gaze sweeping over the guests. All Andorath people take a dim view of brutality, and are not used to such talk, much less such action. Stein bowed his head.
I have yet to learn the exemplary customs of your great culture. I look forward to being given the opportunity to learn your better ways.
With those precisely disarming words, Dalton raised his estimate of the man. Stein's unkempt hair was misleading. What was under it was not nearly so disordered. If Lady Chanvor caught the mordant satire in Stein's repartee, she did not show it as her face relaxed back to its usual sweet and sour set.
We understand and admire your sincere effort to learn what must be strange customs to you.
Her fingertips slid Stein's goblet toward him.
Please, have some of our fine Nerif Valley wine. We are all very fond of it.
If Lady Chanvor failed to grasp the subtle sarcasm in Stein's words, Teresa did not. Unlike Hildemara, Teresa had skirmished much of her adult life among the cut-and-thrust front lines of female social structure, where words were wielded as weapons meant to draw blood. The higher the level of engagement, the more refined the edge. There you had to be adept to know you had been cut and were bleeding, or the wound was all that much greater for others seeing it and you missing it thus. Hildemara didn't need the blade of wit. Raw power alone shielded her. Andorath generals rarely swung swords. As she watched with practical fascination, Teresa took a sip when Stein swept up his goblet for a long swig.
It is good. In fact, I would declare it to be the best I've ever tasted.
We are pleased to hear such a widely traveled man's opinion, the minister said.
Stein thunked his goblet down on the table.
I've had my fill of food. When do I get to speak my piece?
The minister lifted an eyebrow.
When the guests have finished.
Grinning again, Stein stabbed a chunk of meat and leaned back to gnaw it off the knife point. As he chewed, his eyes boldly met the sultry looks he was getting from some of the women. Chapter 22 Musicians up in the gallery piped a nautical tune while ushers unfurled lengthy blue banners down into the dining hall. The pairs of men holding the banners flapped them in time with the music, giving the effect of ocean waves as the fishing boats painted on the banners bobbed upon the blue cloth waters. While the sovereign's own servants catered to his table, squires in estate livery eddied around the minister's head table, bearing silver platters arrayed with the colorfully prepared fish course. The minister selected crab legs, salmon belly, fried minnows, bream, and eels in saffron sauce, the squire placing each item between the minister and his wife for them to transfer as they would to their shared trencher. Minister Chanvor swirled a long piece of eel in the saffron sauce and offered it, draped over a finger, to his wife. She smiled affectionately and, with the tips of long nails, plucked it from his finger. But before putting it to her lips, she instead set it down and turned to Stein to ask, as if suddenly taken with curiosity, about the food of his homeland. In the short time he had been at the estate, Dalton had learned that Lady Chanvor disliked eel above all else. When one of the squires held out a platter of crayfish, Teresa told Dalton by the hopeful lift of her eyebrows that she would like one. The squire deftly split the shell, removed the vein, fluffed the meat, and stuffed the shell beneath with crackers and butter, as Dalton requested. He used his knife to lift a slice of porpoise from a platter held out by a squire, genuflected with his head bowed low between his outstretched arms. The squire, as did they all, before moving on with a dance-like step. Teresa's wrinkled nose told him she didn't want any eel. He took one for himself only because the minister's nodding and grinning told him he should. After he did, the minister leaned close and whispered,
"Eel is good for the eel, if you follow my meaning."
Dalton simply smiled, feigning appreciation for the pointer. His mind was on his job and the task at hand, and besides, he wasn't preoccupied with concern about his eel. As Teresa sampled the gingered carp, Dalton idly tasted the baked herring with sugar as he watched the Haken squires, like an invading army, sweep down on the tables of guests. They brought platters of fried pike, bass, millet, and trout, baked lamprey herring, haddock, and hake, roast perch, salmon, seal, and sturgeon, crabs, shrimp, and whelk on beds of glazed roe, along with tureens of spiced scallop bisque and almond fish stew, in addition to colorful sauces of every kind. Other dishes were served in inventive presentations of sauces and florid concoctions of combined ingredients, from porpoise and peas and onion wine sauce to sturgeon roe and gurnard flanks to great plaice and codling pie and sauce verte. The abundance of food presented in such elaborate profusion was intended not only to be political spectacle wherein the Minister of Culture manifested his power and wealth, but also to convey to protect the minister from accusations of ostentatious excess, a profound religious connotation. The plenty was ultimately an exhibition of the Creator's splendor, and, despite the seeming opulence, but an infinitesimal sampling of his endless bounty. The feast was not convened to oblige a gathering of people, but a gathering of people had been called to attend the feast, a subtle but significant difference. That the feast wasn't held for a social reason, say a wedding or to celebrate an anniversary of a military victory, underlined its religious substance. The sovereign's attendance, his being the Creator's deputy in the world of life, only consecrated the sacred aspects of the feast. If guests were impressed with the wealth, power, and nobility of the minister and his wife, that was incidental and unavoidable. Dalton incidentally noticed a great many people being unavoidably impressed. The room droned with conversation, sprinkled with the chime of laughter as the guests sipped wine, nibbled food of every sort, and sampled with different fingers the variety of sauces. The harpist had started in again to entertain the guests while they dined. The minister ate eel as he spoke with his wife, Stein, and the two wealthy backers at the far end of the table. Dalton wiped his lips, deciding to make use of the opening offered by the relaxed mood. He took a last sip of wine before leaning toward his wife. "Did you find out anything from your talk earlier?" Teresa used her knife to part a piece of fried pike, then picked up her half with her fingers and dipped it in red sauce. She knew he meant Claudine.
"Nothing specific, but I suspect the lamb is not locked in her pen."
Teresa didn't know what the whole matter was about, or that Dalton had enlisted the two Haken boys to deliver a warning to Claudine, but she knew enough to understand that Claudine was probably making trouble over her tryst with the minister. While they never discussed specifics, Teresa knew she wasn't sitting at the head table simply because Dalton knew the law forward and backward. Teresa lowered her voice.
"While I talked with her, she paid a lot of attention to Director Linscott, you know, watching him while trying to act as if she wasn't, watching, too, to see if anyone saw her looking."
Her word was always trustworthy, never embellished with supposition without being tagged as such.
"Why do you think she was so brazen before about telling the other women that the minister forced himself on her?"
"I think she told others about the minister as protection. I believe she reasoned that if people already knew about it, then she was safe from being silenced before anyone could find out. For some reason, though, she has suddenly become close-mouthed. But, like I said, she was watching the director a lot and pretending as if she wasn't."
Teresa left it to him to draw his own conclusions. Dalton leaned toward her as he rose.
"Thank you, darling. If you'll excuse me briefly, I must see to some business."
She caught his hand.
"Don't forget you promised to introduce me to the sovereign."
Dalton lightly kissed her cheek before meeting the minister's eye. What Teresa had said only confirmed his belief in the prudence of his plan. Much was at stake. Director Linscott could be inquisitorial. Dalton was reasonably sure the message delivered by the two boys had silenced Claudine, but if it didn't, this would end her abilities to sow her seeds. He gave Bertrand a slight nod. As he moved around the room, Dalton stopped at a number of tables, leaning over, greeting people he knew, hearing a joke here, a rumor there, a proposal or two, and promised to get together with some. Everyone thought him a representative of the minister, come from the head table to make the rounds of the tables, seeing to everyone's pleasure. Arriving at last at his true destination, Dalton presented a warm smile.
"Claudine, I pray you are feeling better.
Teresa suggested I inquire, see if you need anything, seeing as how Edwin is not able to be here." She flashed him a reasonably good imitation of a sincere smile.
"Your wife is a dear, Master Campbell. I'm fine, thank you. The food and company has put me right. Please tell her I'm feeling much better."
"I'm glad to hear it."
Dalton leaned close to her ear.
"I was going to relay an offer for Edwin and you, but I'm reluctant to ask this of you, not only with Edwin out of the city,
but with your unfortunate tumble, I don't wish to force work on you when you aren't up to it, so please, come to see me when you are fit. She turned to frown at him. Thank you for your concern, but I'm fine. If you have business that involves Edwin, he wishes me to hear it. We work closely and have no secrets where business is concerned. You know that, Master Campbell. Dalton not only knew it, but was counting on it. He squatted down on the balls of his feet as she scooted her chair back to be out of the table's circle of conversation. Please forgive my presumption. Well, you see, he began, the minister feels profound sympathy for men unable to feed their families any other way but to beg food. Even if they can beg food, their families still go for want of clothes, proper shelter, and other necessities. Despite the charity of good Andrith people, many children go to bed with the ache of hunger in their bellies. Hakens as well as Anders suffer this fate, and the minister feels compassion for both, for they are all his responsibility. The minister has labored feverishly, and has at last worked out the final details of a new law to at last put a number of people to work who otherwise would have no hope. That's very good of him, she stammered. Bertrand Chanbor is a good man. We are lucky to have him as our minister of culture. Dalton wiped a hand across his mouth as she looked away from his eyes. Well, the thing of it is, the minister often mentions his respect for Edwin, for all the unsung work Edwin has done. So I suggested to the minister that it would be appropriate to somehow show our respect for Edwin's hard work and dedication. The minister fervently agreed, and instantly sprang to the idea of having the new law headed as proposed and sponsored by Burgess Edwin Winthrop. The minister even wishes it to be called the Winthrop Fair Employment Law in honor of your husband. And you too, of course, for all your work. Everyone knows the input you have in the laws Edwin drafts. Claudine's gaze had already returned to meet his. She put a hand to her breast. Why, Master Campbell, that is very generous of you and the minister. I am completely taken by surprise, as I'm sure Edwin will be. We will certainly review the law as soon as possible, so as to allow its most expeditious implementation. Dalton grimaced. Well, the thing is, the minister just now informed me he is impatient to announce it tonight. I had originally planned to bring you a draft of the law for you and Edwin to review before it was announced. But with all the directors here, the minister decided that, in good conscience, he must act, that he couldn't bear to have those men out of work another day. They need to feed their families. She licked her lips. Well, yes, I understand. I guess, but I really... Good. Oh, good. That is so very kind of you. But I really should have a look at it. I really must see it. Edwin would want... Yes, of course. I understand completely. And I assure you that you will get a copy straight away, first thing tomorrow. But I meant before, with everyone here now, the minister was set on announcing it this evening. The minister really doesn't want to have to delay the implementation, nor does he want to abandon his desire to have the Winthrop name on such a landmark law. And the minister was so hoping that the sovereign, since he is here tonight, and we all know how rare his visits are, would hear of the Winthrop Fair Employment Law designed to help people who otherwise have no hope. The sovereign knows Edwin and would be so pleased. Claudine stole a glance at the sovereign. She wet her lips. But do you wish me to ask the minister to postpone the law? More than the sovereign missing it, the minister would be very disappointed to let the opportunity pass, and to let down those starving children who depend on him to better their lives. You can understand, can't you, that it's really for the sake of the children. Yes, but in order to... Claudine, Dalton said, as he took up one of her hands in both of his. You don't have any children, so I realize it must be particularly difficult for you to empathize with parents desperate to feed their young ones, desperate to find work when there is none. But try to understand how frightened they must be. She opened her mouth, but no words came. He went on, not allowing her the time to form those words. Try to understand what it would be like to be a mother and father waiting day after day, waiting for a reason to hope, waiting for something to happen, so that you could find work and be able to feed your children. Can't you help? Can you try to understand what it must be like for a young mother? Her face had gone ashen. Of course, she finally whispered. I understand. I really do. I want to help. I'm sure Edwin will be pleased when he learns he was named as the law's sponsor. Before she could say anything else, Dalton stood. Thank you, Claudine. He took up her hand again and gave it a kiss.
The minister will be very pleased to hear of your support, and so will those men who will now find work. You have done a good thing for the children. The good spirits must be smiling on you right now. By the time Dalton had returned to the head table, squires were making the rounds again, quickly placing a turtle pie in the center of each table. Guests puzzled at the pies, their crusts quartered but not cut all the way through. Frowning, Teresa was leaning in, staring at the pie placed before the minister and his wife at the center of the head table.
"Dalton," she whispered. "That pie moved of its own accord."
Dalton kept the smile from his face. "You must be mistaken, Tess. A pie can't move."
"But I'm sure."
With that, the crust broke, and a section of it lifted. A turtle poked its head up to peer at the minister. A claw grasped the edge, and the turtle hauled itself out, to be followed by another. All around the room, surprised guests laughed, applauded, and murmured in astonishment as turtles began climbing out of the pies. The turtles, of course, had not been baked alive in the pies. The pies had been baked with dried beans inside. After the crust was baked, a hole was cut in the bottom to allow the beans to be drained out and the turtles put in. The crusts had been cut partly through so it would break easily and allow the animals to make good their escape. The turtle pies, as one of the amusements of the feast, were a grand success. Everyone was delighted by the spectacle. Sometimes it was turtles, sometimes it was birds, both specially raised for the purpose of popping out of pies at a feast to delight and astonish guests. While squires with wooden buckets began making the rounds of the tables to collect the liberated turtles, Lady Chanbur summoned the chamberlain and asked him to cancel the entertainment due to perform before the next course. A hush fell over the room as she rose.
"Good people, if I may have your attention, please."
Hildemar looked to both sides of the room, making sure every eye was upon her. Her pleated dress seemed to glow with cold silver light.
"It is the highest calling and duty to help your fellow citizens when they are in need. Tonight, at last, we hope to take a step to help the children of Andrith. It is a bold step, one requiring courage. Fortunately, we have a leader of such courage. It is my high honor to introduce to you the greatest man I have ever had the privilege to know, a man of integrity, a man who works tirelessly for the people, a man who never forgets the needs of those who need us most, a man who holds our better future above all else. My husband, the Minister of Culture, Bertrand Chanbur."
Hildemar pulled a smile across her face, and clapping, turned to her husband. The room erupted with applause and a great groan of cheering. Beaming, Bertrand stood and slipped an arm around his wife's waist. She stared adoringly up into his eyes. He gazed lovingly down into hers. People cheered louder yet, joyful to have such a high-minded couple boldly leading Andrith. Dalton rose as he applauded with his hands over his head, bringing everyone to their feet. He put on his widest smile so the farthest guest would be able to see it, and then, continuing to applaud loudly, turned to watch the minister and his wife. Dalton had worked for a number of men. Some he could not trust to announce a round of drinks. Some were good at following the plan as Dalton outlined it, but didn't grasp it fully until they saw it unfold. None were in Bertrand Chanbur's league. The minister had immediately grasped the concept and goal, as Dalton had quickly explained it to him. He would be able to embellish it and make it his own. Dalton had never seen anyone as smooth as Bertrand Chanbur. Smiling, holding a hand in the air, Bertrand both acknowledged the cheering crowd and finally silenced them.
"My good people of Andrith," he began in a deep, sincere-sounding voice that boomed into the farthest reaches of the room. "Tonight, I ask you to consider the future. The time is overdue for us to have the courage to leave our past favoritism where it belongs, in the past. We must instead think of our future, and the future of our children and grandchildren.